You are listening to Powder Radio. Brought to you by Powder Magazine.
Welcome back to Sponsored. I'm your host, Mike Powell, and today we have a true pioneer of the free ski movement on the program. I'm talking about Kent Kreitler. And if you don't know Kent's story, well, he grew up in Sun Valley, and he knew at a young age that he wanted to be a professional skier. From the race team to the park to the big mountains, Kent knew skiing was his life. When college rolled around, Kent went to the University of Colorado at Boulder and ended up rooming with one Shane McConkie. Shane and Kent were inseparable in college. They skied as much as they possibly could. They dropped out together. In 1993, they went down to Crested Butte where Kent met his heroes and he became the 1993 Extreme Champion. In 1997, Freeze Magazine named Kent one of the 12 best skiers in the world. He filmed with MSP, he filmed with TGR, he had his own movie, Reverence, and a plethora of sponsors to go along with that. Kent was living the dream as a professional skier, traveling the world, going to Alaska, bagging a lot of first descents, and really just progressing the sport. And then Doug Coombs died, and that made Kent think about his ski career, and it kind of spooked him. Doug had so much knowledge, and he still passed away. Kent started questioning what he was doing in the mountains and realized it was time for a change in life. Kent went the Buddhist way, the yogi way, buying land in Panama way, and we're going to talk to Kent about all those things that he's doing. We'll talk to him about his amazing ski career and what is next for Kent Kreitler.
Sorry, I was downstairs for a minute.
Oh, it's all good, man. How you doing?
Good. Should I just turn off the video?
It's weird that you have no clothes on, but yeah, I mean, if you want to turn off the video, you can. If not, it's pretty impressive stuff that you're working with, Kent. Nice.
You already got me there.
I mean, it's weird. Michelle Parker did the same thing.
I like to do all my interviews in the nude, so.
Yeah, it should make you more comfortable and not nervous if you can look down and just see your junk. It should get you talking a little bit more.
Yeah, I like to be stimulated.
So do I. So do I, and it's been so long. Well, Kent, I want to thank you for coming on. For me, just growing up and being a big fan and skier and reading all the magazines, you were one of those guys that was always out in front of the limelight, especially in the late 90s when things were really happening. You were right there making that stuff happen, and we're going to talk about that, but I want to get some background on you, and it looks like you're from Jersey.
I'm from Sun Valley. You know, I lived in New Jersey as a kid, so... like until I was 10 years old. And then in the fifth grade, we moved to Haley, Idaho, which is 10 miles down the road. And so I grew up in what's known as the Sun Valley area, which is Haley, Ketchum, Sun Valley.
So you're born and raised in Jersey and then Sun Valley at 10 years old?
Yeah, I was born in Kansas City, Missouri.
Okay.
Actually. And then, New Jersey early. Yeah, I kind of had these an East Coast parenting influence, but growing up in Idaho, so kind of an interesting mix.
So how did you end up going to Idaho? Sun Valley is one of the most expensive places in the entire world to live. Did your parents get super rich in Jersey and say, hey, we're going to Sun Valley?
Well, first of all, Sun Valley is actually really inexpensive compared to every other ski town. Like you can, if you go on the multiple listing service, you can still buy condominiums here for $250,000-$300,000. But we moved to Haley. It was more like, I think it was more of like a lifestyle change decision. My parents were having trouble with their marriage and were just looking for a big change and the idea of moving to a ski area, which they were never either really fanatical skiers. When I lived in New Jersey, I was already fanatical about skiing. You know, I'm really glad they made the move. However, I can't really pinpoint a reason except just to change things up and try to save their marriage, which ended up dissolving 4 years later anyway.
And did they both stay in Sun Valley?
No. In fact, my mother was more of a West Coast mentality person. She ended up back here after bouncing around a little bit for a while, but she spent the last years of her life here in Haley. And then my dad is definitely more of an East Coaster and never really, I would say, adapted to more like the West Coast mentality. And he actually moved back to the East Coast like 15 or so, maybe more years ago. And he's definitely, you know, more at home there.
Okay. So you get to Sun Valley. And do you get immediately put into the ski school or the race team? How does your skiing start at Sun Valley?
Yeah, it was cool. The first year, I just free skied. I had, it was, you know, I was more of a weekend skier, 10 years old, so fifth grade, and I wasn't on one of the ski teams. And then the second year I was here, I joined the Haley ski team, which is that there's a little mountain called Rotor Run down in Haley. And I was on the Haley ski team so I could start doing after school. And I started making some really, at that time, bonding with some of my buddies who were on the team. And some of those guys are still here now. And then the following year, when I graduated from elementary school or whatever you call that, I went to the private school in Ketchum, and we also moved to Ketchum. So at that time, I transitioned to the Sun Valley ski team.
And in Sun Valley, there was a ton of amazing racers there, I would think. And that had to be just a ton of competition, and it must have gotten you better a lot faster skiing with some amazing skiers like Peekaboo was there, the Chris brothers.
Well, so Peekaboo and I are the same age. Reggie is a little older. Zach is a little younger. Who else was here at that time? I mean, I think those are the people that you would think of. I hate to be forgetting someone, but so I grew up in the Intermountain. Well, I grew up racing against Novus a bit from Park City. So I got to know some of the crew. Intermountain's Jackson Hole, the Salt Lake City ski areas, and Sun Valley. It was basically the range then. I'm not sure what it is now, but so there was some crossover with some other guys, Tommy Moe. So yeah, we all kind of bounced around each other at that age. During, you know, 7th to 11th or 12th grade.
And how were you as a racer?
You know, I did really well, but I was rarely like a podium. I was like a top 10 guy, but not like a podium guy. And part of that was like, I really didn't enjoy racing. Like, I loved the training and I thought it was fun. And lots of the training is, you know, we go free skiing anyway.
Yeah.
But I actually quit I quit racing after my junior year in high school. Yeah, I wasn't really loving the racing. And when I started doing more of the, what they're calling free skiing or big mountain, or back then it was extreme skiing or just, you know, going out and having fun. Like, that was just more my thing. I just loved going out. In fact, Sun Valley was a fantastic mogul skiing mountain. And had we had a freestyle team, I'd say there would have been a really good chance I would have been on the freestyle team just because I skied bumps all the time in my free time back then. But we didn't have a freestyle team.
So no freestyle team. So you're just going free skiing and you're just really having fun out there. And at that point in your life, do you know that you want to be a professional skier in some respect?
Yeah. I mean, for a while, yeah, but it didn't really take shape because the discipline that I ended up being part of the pioneering crew in didn't really exist. And so like, absolutely love skiing. I mean, growing up in Sun Valley is really cool because despite the fact that we've somewhat fallen off the face in the 70s and 80s, like, we were really known to be like this fantastic mogul ski mountain, a big hub. Like, growing up here, you grow up with the Barrymore movies and Warren Miller movies, and both those guys are from Sun Valley. So you grew up seeing movies about your mountain, guys ripping moguls and throwing huge tricks. And so like, you had, like, I had that influence and loved, like, and was really drawn to that. However, like, you know, that wasn't really considered a profession back in those days.
No, but it's amazing that the guys at Sun Valley, the Bobby Burnses of the world, they were kind of the pioneers of creating an ability to get paid as a skier without having to race. And it's neat that that started in Sun Valley and you were able to kind of see that as you through those movies. And eventually that became you. You were the second generation. It kind of went from Bobby Burns to the Plakes to your crew. And you guys were able to make money and being a professional skier by not competing. And that's pretty phenomenal. And I'm going to fast forward a little bit. So you leave Sun Valley and you go to University of Colorado at Boulder.
Right.
Your roommate there is, I think, a guy who skied, Shane McConkey.
Shane and I became roommates our sophomore year in college, along with two other guys from Sun Valley. One of them's Jake Witt, who ran Freeze magazine. And then now I don't know his title, but he's with the U.S. ski team.
Yeah, I think he's like the Sultan of the ski team or something like that.
Yeah, he's pretty high up at this point.
You've got some fun roommates who are passionate about skiing as you are. And tell us some of the fun stories that happened with McConkey and yourself in college. You know, some of the stuff that you don't want anyone to know because a lot of people do want to know.
Oh, God. There are probably quite a few.
We just want the best couple ones that people haven't heard.
Okay, well, here's like one of the best ones, I would say. This goes in the inappropriate questions category. But like one of our, and Jake Witt will attest to this too, because we crack up about it, even though it's somewhat destructive, but we basically started the Boulder riots, which became like a little bit of an annual event. There was this huge windstorm and all these branches were knocked down all over Boulder and no one cleaned them up. And then one day, it was actually, I think it was my birthday, I don't know, but we ended up piling up all the branches in the middle of our intersection on 10th and Pennsylvania in Boulder. And then we like, someone, maybe Shane, I don't know, but not like, I honestly don't, can't remember, although I think it was Shane, but finally someone got the balls to light the fire. And then we had this enormous fire going and people, and then all these people started showing up in Boulder with like, it's, or I guess any college town, but you know, with your hippies and everything else, like, you know, naked people dancing around the fire, people throwing mattresses on it, couches, the works. And then, you know, this thing goes on for a couple of hours and then all of a sudden it's like riot police coming in to break it up, like people throwing bottles, like literally like 50 to 100 riot police coming into the intersection from all four directions. And then like, I don't know. So then that became that for a while. If you Google Boulder riots, you'll see it became a little bit of an annual event. But that was probably one of our most notable impacts on Boulder.
Do you guys get in trouble for that?
Absolutely not. No one had any idea who did that. We had a lot of fun. And then, you know, some of the other guys, we had some other friends from Ketchum who would come down. And I remember at one point none of us were interested in being in fraternities, which is like a big thing in college, right? But yeah. We'd all grown up in ski towns and maybe with just more liberal lifestyles and just not attracted to that. But we had a lot of friends in fraternities. But I remember like there was one time when we like took the entire sound system out of one of the fraternities at like 4 a.m, these enormous speakers and brought them over to our house. And yeah, I don't know. If I start digging, I can probably come up with.
No, I just wanted to kind of get an idea of what it was like. And I think starting a tradition of riots kind of outlines what you guys were doing in college other than skiing. And then you guys probably went and skied as much as you possibly could together, I would think.
Yeah, we had Vail. By that time I think we had Summit or Vail passes. And yeah, we were every weekend and then trying to put all our classes on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Shane was trying to manage ski racing for part of it and was still on the ski team, I think the first year, or I can't remember the details on that. But yeah, anyway, yeah, we did ski a lot.
And then eventually you guys dropped out of school and wanted to focus on skiing. And I know you had connections with Vallant and Spider. How did those connections come together? And it sounds like you hooked Shane up with those connections as well.
Yeah, that was just one of those small, the small incidents that all of a sudden track your life into some other direction. I was in Sun Valley and this guy, Tim Patterson, who was with Vallant before they started selling skis, was here. And then I just went free skiing on the skis. And then I broke some of the skis. And so then Tim was like, okay, well, we're doing this set. That was at the end of the season, I think, or something. And then Tim was like, and then I moved to Boulder and I was like, hey, I'm in Boulder now. If you guys have anything come up, let me know. And he was like, hey, we want to send you down to South America. We redesigned the ski. Cause I think I ended up breaking two pairs in Sun Valley, just okay, skiing on them. They were like, hey, we want to send you down to Las Leñas to see if you can break any skis. So anyway, one thing led to another, and I was kind of hooked up with Vallant, and then they were next door to Spider, and so they were, you know, they were calling saying, hey, can you go do a photo shoot for us? And we just need to get, you know, we need some, at that time, models to shoot on the skis doing some cool stuff. And so I did that for a while and connected with Spider and Vallant, and then, yeah, and then eventually brought Shane into that mix as well.
When you get that call, hey, we want to send you down to Las Leñas, and you probably haven't had too many paid trips, are you shitting your pants at that point?
I was, you know, I can't remember, but, what was I thinking then? I mean, obviously pretty excited. I ended up flying in there. I went down with Hank Cashua.
Okay.
And just one other guy who was, and then at the time there was like Pan Am Games. So the US ski team was down there. So I ended up, it was weird, like back then, you know, like no one was really free skiing. And so literally showed up, huge snowstorm, like had Marte, the whole mountain, like literally to myself. And this is before I had any Abbey training, and I was skiing like all these lines off the top with like literally just doing laps, looking at my own tracks with maybe like one or two other people.
That's amazing.
And, you know, luckily, I made it through a couple of years with pretty low avalanche knowledge without getting into any incidents. So I was pretty lucky during those times because those were pre all this. So those areas weren't controlled. I don't think the patrol even considered that anyone would try to ski a lot of that stuff. But yeah, anyway, it ended up snowing the whole time, so I didn't break any skis. I was like, you know, I was literally trying to land on rocks by the end because I was trying to do the job I was sent down there for. But yeah, definitely very stoked, trying to figure out how I could get more of those put together.
And so that's kind of the start, really, of your professional career traveling. You pick up some sponsors from there. I know at one point you're filming with Nick Nixon, I think, and then MSP, and then TGR. So you film with you know, a lot of the heavies out there. But how did the career progress? You know, you got swept up into becoming the face of free skiing with a couple other people, and how did that happen? What was the excitement like in the industry? I know 1997, Fries named you one of the best skiers in the world, but what was that like, and just the newness of it and the excitement around free skiing?
It was fun. I mean, we were, at this time I say kids, you know, we were kids really mostly trying to have a good time and doing something that we absolutely loved. 93, coincidentally, I guess Shane was my roommate, and I went and won the US Extreme Skiing Championships. And I think he was still doing some racing. And I think this is in his movie. I was like, hey, I'm gonna go do this event. We made fun of the term extreme skiing. We thought it was silly. And you know, of course, you know, Shane kind of carried that forward in terms of just making fun of things all the time. But we always thought, you know, I can't believe they call this event extreme skiing. But so like that for me, I mean, the only reason I bring that up is for me, that was like a big turning point, because I met Seth was in that event. Doug Coombs was in that event. Jim Zell was in that event. Dave Swanwick was in that event. Dean Cummings was in that event. And I met all of them. And for me, that was impressionable. And it became like a turning point where I met guys from all different disciplines of the sport who were kind of united in this extreme skiing championships cause, and really because everyone just loved it and loved the adventure aspect of it. And it gave us a forum to all get together and really have a blast and perform against each other. So yeah, in terms of just the early fun, yeah, I mean, it's a lot of work. You know, all of us, Seth, Shane, myself, really having a great time and also working really hard to make it happen at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, it took a lot of work. The ski brands were putting money behind the free skiing segment at that point. It started to happen. You became part of that first K2 factory team, which to me was a turning point in the way that athletes were marketed in the ski industry, because you looked at snowboard and they had a bunch of teams and they were marketing the athletes as a group and collective going around. But at that time, skiing was kind of dead in the water. Seeing that one team being promoted around, you know, you look at all the other ski brands after that, everybody had a team of athletes together and they were all free skiers and they were all doing something different and making an impact on the industry. And that's really what kind of skiing became.
Skiing at the time was absolutely getting clobbered by snowboarding, probably somewhat financially, and then also just in terms of the image with kids and having and making it fun. And, you know, I don't know where, you know, Scott and Glenn and Trevor and Eric and the other guys had already like lit the fire. Some people say free skiing wouldn't have happened without snowboarding, but I tend to think it would have anyway. The park aspect, you know, it definitely helped have that definitely was kickstarted by snowboarding. However, yeah. So anyway, like the industry needed it. And I think the most frustrating thing for us is we all knew that it had the potential to save the industry, so to speak. And it just took the ski industry so long to wrap their heads around it and to actually get behind it. Even though the films were coming out and we were all living in ski bums, you know, for a while. It took a while to be making some money. And even then, I don't know. I hear it's tough now. I mean, it's been difficult to get the ski industry really behind it. However, obviously now it's just a huge piece of the equation.
Yeah, I think a bulk of the sales come from that category that you helped create. As a professional skier, what was the most money you made in one season?
I was doing like about $120,000.
Wow.
For several seasons, just because I had like, I was with Spider for years, and that worked its way up to like a $60,000 contract. And then I made some moves between ski sponsors, which, you know, let's talk, for example, I loved K2. Rozzy made me a great offer and I ended up leaving. And then my team manager at Rozzy ended up getting fired like a few months later. So that somewhat backfired on me after like 3 years. Then I moved on to Blizzard, but still sort of staying in that realm of being like, hey, this is what I get paid. So yeah, so anyway, I did pretty well for a while, really well, by my standard.
No, that's amazing. You're able to ski and do what you're passionate about and actually make a lot of money doing it. And I'm sure when you were making that money, you were probably not putting it all away. You were probably having a little bit of a rock star life too at the same time. Is that correct?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I made a couple good moves on real estate where I got lucky. Because I know I got lucky because since then I've made some bad moves.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, you tend to blow through it. And, you know, one thing I'm always, you know, you probably saw me put something on Facebook recently about just it being like with action sports, it's tough. I mean, like you don't necessarily really make enough money that you can retire on. It's not like being in the NBA or the NFL or other like bigger professional sports in this country anyway. I can't speak for Europe where it's a bigger deal, but anyway, so yeah, it's easy to blow through it.
Yeah, it's not even close to what a professional athlete in a different sport's like. I mean, if you think about it, you were at the top of your profession. You're probably one of the highest paid skiers in the world at that point who's not a racer, and you're making $120K where a computer programmer makes $120K.
Exactly.
So yeah, it's not something to retire on.
Earlier, in terms of Sun Valley or any ski town, you're living in very expensive town. So like, if it's, I mean, one thing I'd say to athletes is, whatever you're not committed to spend, to whatever you're not committing, you're gonna probably spend on a new snowmobile every year or whatever it is. And I think one of the best moves I made was to buy my home, because then at least I was committed to that mortgage, and that was an investment. And that's my place in Squaw literally carried me through I sold it and it carried me through some pretty challenging times after I retired in 2008.
Okay, so when you retire in 2008, did some reading and background on your retirement. It sounds like Coombs, him passing away, had a huge impact on your psyche on skiing. And it seemed like that, from what I read, and I'm talking to you now, so we'll get the real answer, but it sounded like that spooked you and almost scared you and kind of a paradigm shift within your brain. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, there's two parts of that. Like, that was part of it. Also, I was really unafraid of, for one thing, dying. I was just very, like, when I was younger, I was very, like, was very unafraid and just very passion-driven. And really, I loved like all the middle and early parts of my career because it was so explorative. And I really have a drive to be like doing things that are, I like original ideas and I like pursuing ideas that are, at that age anyway, I liked pursuing like being a pioneer. Like one of the biggest thrills for me was being a pioneer and like literally everything we did in Alaska, even like New Zealand, was going to mountain ranges that people had really never skied before. And so I absolutely loved that along with the skiing. And so then, yeah, Doug had just a weird accident where he slipped on some ice and other people had been injured. And I'd been through a major injury where I dislocated my knee. And my final comeback off of that was kind of like, it gave me a purpose to recover from that horrendous knee injury.
Yep.
And like once I got through that purpose, I was like, okay, well, what are my goals at this point? And what do I want? What have I achieved that were my goals? And like, where do I take it from here? And there wasn't that much left for me at that time. And I was getting older, and I also was considering what I was going to need to be doing for the rest of my life if I wanted to continue living in a ski town, and needing to start looking at what options I was going to be putting on the table so that I could keep skiing and living in a ski town. And I was never, yeah. So that's basically my answer on that.
So it didn't get to the point where you're standing on top of a peak and you're scared and you don't want to do it, or did that happen?
Well, you go through ups and downs. Like some years you're really aggressive and game on, and then I mean, for me at that time, the other thing that we went through a lot of, that I would assume some of my peers experienced, is like it was very uncharted terrain. Like we didn't have a data field to pull from. We didn't have like elders for the most part that we could, or even a history of films that we could pull ideas, comfort, material, learning from. So like, I think like it got to a point where it got a little exhausting for me, and I felt like I'd kind of, yeah, I just felt, for me, like I know there's guys like Jeremy Jones who, it seems like he just keeps going.
Right.
For me, it just felt like it had kind of run its course, and there was like a level of intensity. It's, you know, people watch ski films and they think, oh my God, these guys are so lucky. And you really are lucky. Like it's blessed, no doubt. And I'm super grateful. However, like And that, you know, honestly, like they have equipment that functions easier now. While I was in the film days, people had to stop, load film. If you were doing a helmet cam, it was a somewhat major scenario to set up a helmet cam. You know, and you're waiting for filmers to change film, and there's just like a lot of waiting that goes on, and there's a lot of like not skiing that goes on, and there's a lot of sitting in between your ski days, and that are pretty non-productive. I don't know. I think like for me, like over time, it just felt like it had run its course to some extent. However, you know, now I'd love to like go on a few trips, having had some time out from it.
Yeah, I'm sure there's opportunities for you to guide trips and take people out. I'm sure there's a lot of people that would want to ski with Kent Kreitler.
I don't know, maybe. I haven't, you know, I've thought about getting into that line, but as you know, now I have a 3-year-old, it's tough to leave home. And I'm working on some other things that don't necessarily give me the flexibility. But that was one of the game plans that I was considering. And I think like for me, like where my ego and everything else was when I retired from skiing, like I wasn't really ready for that. Like I wouldn't have been able to make that transition. Whereas like now it would be a great fit for me. But at that time, just segueing into guiding it just didn't appeal to me.
So at that time, you're on top of the world as a professional skier, but then you hang it up. And how does that feel? What are the next 2 years like for you? Is there depression? Are you trying to find something to replace skiing? What are you going through?
I had bought this property in Panama back in 2004.
Why?
For $250,000, I bought 150 acres down in Panama. And I instantly had kind of like this other project to focus on. And I was sick. Honestly, I was sick of skiing in the ski industry. And I moved to San Fran. And so I was bouncing between San Fran and Panama. I got certified as a yoga instructor, and I went through these life coaching courses, and I was involved in the Burning Man community, and just really got to do something really different from what I've been doing for 15 years. So I embrace that time. I'm really happy to be back in a ski town now, but I really turned my back on it completely. Like I walked away from contracts. I mean, I just knew it was time to call it.
And was it just too much, people wanting too much of your time, or is it the expectation of you have to be badass wherever you go?
It was more for me, like I was 38 and I was getting to where I felt like I had value based on my past accomplishments, if not more value, but like value in terms of just being able to move product, which is what it comes down to as an athlete. Like you're really your marketing tool. I felt like my marketing tool ability was still there, but yeah, that was a time when all, you know, there was a big hot new flock of skiers coming in, just another round of sort of like new, what do we do now, energy in the ski industry. And, I felt like I started feeling like I was about to embark on this other pioneering mission, which was establishing my value as a veteran skier versus a super relevant athletic on the athletic side.
Yep.
And I was testing the waters there, and I was offered contracts that were lower. I was really blatantly honest with my sponsors. I just said, look, you know, I'm totally welcome. I'd love to go to trade shows. I'd love to like do some trips and definitely like tee off several days a year to get you guys the photos that you need for ads. But I'm not, I told them I'm just not willing to go on these 3-week to 8-week filming trips cooped up with a bunch of guys in a shack somewhere so I can throw down like the hardest runs of my life, you know, after sitting for a week to 2 weeks waiting for the sun to come out. Like, so I kind of just stated like where I was with it. And at the time, you know, people were just, they were also, you know, like I said, they were focusing their energy on some fresh talent. And I assume this may have been what just happened with Seth with K2, but I was offered some significantly lower contracts than I'd been on. And instead of kind of hanging in there, I just walked. And like in retrospect, like maybe I should have just taken that money and then also been working on my other things. But it was totally liberating for me to just get away from it completely and be doing my own thing separately on my own time. And to get to the skiing side of it, like I had so much fun skiing after I'd left the ski industry, because I was just on some old, like I had a pair of old Morrisons, and I just kind of was scrapping for skis. I was on clothes that I wore for 3 years finally. And I was just, you know, I was just back to where I didn't owe anything to anyone. I didn't have to show up for anything. And I just had a blast when I did get out.
Yeah, it's got to feel like the monkey's been lifted off your back and you can kind of go do whatever you want. And that's a very freeing feeling. So you said you bought 150 acres in Panama, and are you still doing work on that property, and what is that all about?
Yeah, I have a couple partners on it, but yeah, it's like a remote surf. It's pretty remote surf, but it's getting, you know, after 12 years, it's gotten quite a bit less remote, which was my vision. I was like, okay, you know, they're not making any more beachfront is the saying in real estate, I guess, but it's on a good surf break, and it's incredibly beautiful. So I lived there. I drove this huge truck through Central America. I camped on the beach. It was kind of like another pioneering mission.
Okay.
And then after several years, I kind of came to the conclusion. I was like, God, you know what? I'm in another like crazy pioneering mission, living on the land, dealing with, you know, jungle cowboys, like some awesome people, but just out, you know, work. I love physical labor, out just doing like a lot of work outside every day. And so now I've like stepped back to where I want to manage that from more of a satellite position and just make it work as an investment. But for a while it was very hands-on, and once again, another pioneering mission. And in the end, it looks like I'm going to come out on top pretty well on that.
That's awesome.
So it's been worth it. But it's, you know, I tell you what, running a business in Latin America is an absolute circus. I mean, doing something like this.
Yeah, anytime I've dealt with anyone in Latin America, everything is no problem, but nothing actually happens.
Exactly. Yeah.
Kent, when you look at the ski industry today, what does skiing need? What's it missing? What do you think of the landscape of skiing?
I don't know. It's weird. Like I was putting together these Sammy, who I've met, who I just think he just came across as a really grounded, sweet guy. When I met him last year at the TGR premiere, I was putting together these inappropriate questions for him. And I honestly, like, I've read like one Powder magazine since I retired. I've looked at maybe a total of 5 ski magazines total. And I have watched a few of the films, but I'm really out of touch, and I've really enjoyed being out of touch. However, and I totally respect everything that's going on, but it was fun. Like, I watched Sammy's film last night, and I just don't know that much about a lot of these guys. Like, there's a couple people who I really like. Like, I really like Dane Tudor, his skiing. I've been impressed by Pep. He kind of came in right around when I left, pretty strong. And then Jeff Pettit, that's a snowboarder.
Sean Pettit,
yeah. And so, like, I've gotten glimpses of some of the guys that I love what's going on. Yeah, what can I tell you? I don't know that much.
No, it sounds like that you've taken your career and you experienced the best of what skiing was at a very progressive time in the ski world, really, when snowboarding had taken over and ski was taking the reins back, and you were part of that group that took it back. And now you're out of the ski industry, but you're never going to really be out of it. But you're not a day-to-day player in the ski industry, and that's got to be a liberating feeling for you, and not knowing exactly what's going on in the ski world. Who cares, right? You just want to go out and have fun, and when you see people, you're going to high-five them, and they're going to tell you what they were up to, but you don't need to watch the videos to see what's going on because you lived it.
Yeah, somewhat, and then I actually would love... I mean, it's also fun because I have a lot of videos I can catch up on. I really enjoyed watching Sammy's movie last night, and... you know, like last year, I had a fantastic ski season. By the way, like, I've reconnected with some sponsors because I got to where I needed gear again. And I did want to get more involved. I've been up to AK once in the last couple of years. I went to France. Like, I kind of got to this point where I was like, okay, I'm kind of ready to re-engage now. However, what I found is that there's really not an opening for me at this point, and people aren't that interested. But luckily, I'm able to get like a nice quiver of free gear out of the deal and do, you know, a little bit locally, or, you know, I'm skiing with K2, and I just kind of went with Oakley on everything else, just because I know those guys. I have a history. Like, Strokes with Oakley is one of the only guys who's been in the industry for like 25 years as a team manager. Like, I don't know anyone who's been in that position for so long. And all of my old sponsors have consolidated, become part of other companies. And I, you know, for the most part, I don't even know people there anymore. So that all kind of went out of reach. But anyway, I'm not sure what I was going to, but I skied more POW last year than I ever have in my life. And that was just lift access POW skiing here in Sun Valley.
Yeah, well, you're not playing the hurry up and wait game anymore that filming happens to be. So you're able to actually make turns when you get to the top of the hill.
Yeah, I actually have an aversion to cameras at this point.
It's like PTSD with cameras.
I kind of want to run the other way, but I did a couple fo- I did a fo- I did some fo- I did a couple days of photo shoots last year, and it was fun. And it's fun to show people around this area. We had some ski magazine people in town, and during some epic conditions. So that was, it was fun. And like I said, like if I was given the opportunity to go to AK and do a segment, I'd do it, just because I went up a couple years ago, and I do absolutely love the atmosphere and the rush. And if I'm not, if I was doing just a couple weeks of it and it wasn't my whole season, I would thoroughly enjoy it. My hope is that one of the projects that I'm involved in, a couple business situations right now, but I'd love to get to where I can just finance like a really fun Alaska trip without someone else paying for it here. So we'll see what happens in the next several years.
Yeah, it'd be nice to do that on your own terms. My last question for you is, how many pairs of your pro model ski do you have?
I'm trying to get some back. I kind of have like a Buddhist practice of non-attachment, and at one point I just got rid of all that. Luckily, I gave like one of everything to the local ski museum in Sun Valley. So I was really trying to collect some stuff for my daughter, but I have some of the old K2s, and then I think I've got a pair of the Blizzard Pro models in Tahoe at a friend's house. I mean, I don't really have that stuff. If anyone has any of it, I might ask you to send it to me.
Well, Ken, I've got a pair brand new in the plastic. I will sell them to you for $3,500. Ken, I'm going to thank you for your time, and we're going to hop over to thepalmovement.com. We'll do inappropriate questions, but thanks for coming out, and it's been a pleasure just watching your career, and you really helped change skiing, and that's huge. You can take that to the grave, as you were one of the pioneers that helped change the look and feel of what skiing is, and that's something to be proud of.
Well, thanks, Mike. I appreciate that, and I'm so grateful to have been part of all the people that were part of that and who were part of my life. So it's just, you know, we're all so blessed to be involved in it at all. So thanks. And thanks for everything you do.
Oh, well, thank you, man. And I will talk to you soon.
Okay, good. Take care.
So that was my time with Kent Kreitler, a pioneer of free skiing and an all-around great guy. There's more Kent Kreitler over on thepalmovement.com. We have inappropriate questions. Michelle Parker will ask three questions to Kent, and then Kent will give answers and then put together three questions for next week's guest, Sammy Carlson. As always, if you want to ask questions for next week's guest or give show feedback, you can reach me at mike@thepalmovement.com or follow me on Twitter, palmovement1. Thanks for listening to Sponsored, presented by Powder Magazine. I'm your host, Mike Powell. Thanks and have a great day.